Kim Purcell is an award-winning real estate sales representative working under the Sutton Group Masters Realty Brokerage. Kim was born and raised in Kingston and is into her ninth year of real estate. She has intimate knowledge of the area, which has positively influenced her career as a realtor and led to numerous five-star reviews from clients. If you're looking for a real estate agent in the Kingston area who is trustworthy and will work for your best interests, you're in good hands with Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca to learn more about Kim's realty services and listings today.
Democracy Now.
Today we take a very historic action that was 45 years in the making. In a few moments, I will sign an executive order to begin eliminating the federal Department of Education once and for all.
President Trump signs an executive order calling for the dismantling of the U.S. Department of Education, but the agency can't be completely shuttered without congressional approval. What does the agency do? Then, an update on Mahmoud Khalil, the Columbia student protest leader who's now spent 14 days in ICE detention, even though he had a green card. He'll also look at how the State Department's using artificial intelligence to identify pro-Palestinian foreign nationals to target for deportation.
This has been weaponized by the Trump administration to search for pro-Palestinian and anti-American protesters in order to revoke their visas or their green cards and deport them from the country.
Then the newly declassified JFK assassination documents shed new light on covert CIA operations from Latin America to the Vatican. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's military has launched a full-scale ground invasion in Rafah as it relentlessly attacks the Gaza Strip for the fourth straight day since Israel unilaterally shattered the ceasefire with Hamas. Israeli troops are also pushing into the north near Beit Lahia and other areas. At least 200 Palestinian children have been killed in Israeli attacks since Tuesday. This is a mother in Khan Yunis whose daughter was killed in an Israeli strike.
Stop this war. Stop this extermination. This is an extermination of the entire Palestinian people. What is the fault of the children? These children, what is their fault? For every child, you bring 100. What is this? Shame on you. The entire square, not a stone or anything remains. It is all destroyed. They left nothing in the whole area.
UNRWA has announced 5 of its workers have been killed in recent days. This brings the total of all UNRWA workers killed in Israeli attacks on Gaza over the past 18 months to 284. President Trump Thursday signed an executive order to start dismantling the Department of Education.
My administration will take all lawful steps to shut down the department. We're going to shut it down and shut it down as quickly as possible. It's doing us no good. We want to return our students to the states.
The department cannot be fully shut down without an act of Congress, but Trump's order directs Education Secretary Linda McMahon to shutter regional officers, transfer out some of its key functions, further slash the department's workforce, which has already been cut in half since Trump took office. The fate of public education, funding, labor, civil rights protections, financial aid for students now hangs in the balance. Protests are planned for today in D.C. and beyond. We'll have more on Trump's executive order and its implications after headlines. A federal judge temporarily blocked Elon Musk and his Department of Government Efficiency, DOGE, from accessing Social Security Administration databases containing personal information. Judge Ellen Hollander also ordered DOGE to delete identifiable personal data it may have already obtained and to remove software installed on Social Security systems. In her opinion, the judge wrote, the DOGE team is essentially engaged in a fishing expedition at SSA in search of a fraud epidemic based on little more than suspicion, she said. Federal Judge James Boasberg accused the Trump Justice Department of, quote, again evading their obligations and presenting woefully insufficient information around its deportation flights to Venezuelan immigrants under the Alien Enemies Act. Judge Boasberg had ordered the administration to present the information after it violated the judge's order last weekend to halt and turn around removal flights to El Salvador. Meanwhile, lawyers and loved ones of the deported individuals say they've been falsely accused of belonging to the Tren de Aragua gang simply because they have tattoos. One of them is professional soccer player Jerse Reyes Barrios. His lawyer says the tattoo that landed him on the deportation list depicts a crown sitting on top of a soccer ball with a rosary and the word Dios, God, chosen by Barrios as a nod to the Real Madrid soccer team logo. In Venezuela, families of deportees have pleaded to authorities to bring their loved ones home in reports of serious abuses at El Salvador's mega supermax prison where they're being held.
We ask the corresponding authorities, the UN, to please join us. We want to know the whereabouts of our children. Please return them to us if they are in El Salvador. They are not criminals.
In more immigration news, the private for-profit company GEO Group has announced a new contract with Immigration and Customs Enforcement that'll see the reopening of a shuttered Michigan prison to start detaining immigrants and asylum seekers. The Northlake facility in Baldwin would become one of the largest ICE jails in the country with a capacity of at least 1,800 people. Northlake closed in 2022 as part of President Biden's executive order to end the use of private prisons by federal government. Detention Watch Network said in a statement, quote, the perverse financial incentives are glaring as GEO Group stands to generate an excess of $70 million in annualized revenue from Northlake at the expense of people's lives, unquote. GEO Group's stock value has soared since Trump returned to office. This comes as the National Labor Relations Board has dropped a case accusing GEO Group of retaliating against immigrant detainees who protested over low pay and dangerous working conditions. Detainees are paid as little as $1 a day for their labor. President Trump rescinded an executive order targeting the law firm Paul Weiss, Rifkin, Wharton & Garrison after meeting in person with its chair this week. Under the deal, the law firm will provide $40 million in free legal services supporting Trump's agenda, including his task force to combat anti-Semitism. Last week, Trump's order threatened to revoke the firm's security clearances and end its federal contracts over its association with former partner Mark Pomerantz, who oversaw the Manhattan District Attorney's probe into Trump's finances. The news has set off alarm in the legal profession. The firm is associated with Democratic causes and is known for fighting civil rights cases against the government. The White House denied reports Elon Musk will be briefed on potential war plans with China when he visits the Pentagon today. The meeting represents a significant expansion of Musk's access to sensitive government information and underscores his many conflicts of interest. His companies, including SpaceX and Tesla, have received billions of dollars in government contracts, including with the Pentagon, and Musk has major financial interests in China. Rwanda-backed M23 fighters have seized another key town in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. The rebel group entered the mining hub of Walikale on Wednesday. M23's latest advance comes after Congolese President Felix Tshisekedi and Rwandan President Paul Kagame called for an immediate ceasefire in the Eastern DRC following peace talks in Doha mediated by Qatar. But M23 leaders are not backing down.
They have put prices on our arrest. We have nothing more to lose. We will fight until our cause is heard. Meanwhile, what happened in Doha, as long as we don't know the details and as long as it doesn't solve our problems, we will say it does not concern us.
In Sudan, military forces have recaptured the presidential palace in Khartoum, a major victory for the Sudanese army after nearly 2 years of war against the rapid support forces. Over 28,000 people have been killed since the conflict began in April 2023, with millions forcibly displaced from their homes in what the UN has described as the world's largest humanitarian crisis. In Turkey, mass protests continue over the arrest of Istanbul Mayor Ekrem İmamoğlu, a major rival to Turkey's authoritarian president Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Turkish authorities have detained at least 37 people over social media posts in support of İmamoğlu, who was taken into custody Wednesday on what his backers say are trumped-up charges ahead of primary elections on Sunday. Protesters took to the streets of Istanbul.
Bugün Türkiye demokrasisine bir darbe yapıldı, sivil darbe.
This is a coup to the national will and democracy. When viewed from foreign countries today, Turkey is seen as having an appearance where democracy is over, justice is over, and everyone who is not with the government is in prison. Do you actually know what this is like? It is proof that now the one-man regime is saying that there are no elections in Turkey. I am king. There will be no elections.
At least six people have been killed, another 40 still missing after a rubber dinghy carrying refugees capsized Tuesday in the Mediterranean off the Italian island of Lampedusa. Only 10 survivors have been rescued. The boat departed from Sfax, Tunisia, and the passengers were from Cameroon, Ivory Coast, Guinea, and Mali. At least 270 refugees have already died this year trying to cross the Mediterranean to seek safety in Europe. Over 30 UCLA students who were brutalized last spring during Gaza solidarity protests have sued campus officials and law enforcement agencies. Students had set up peaceful campus encampment demanding an end to UCLA's financial ties with Israel's war. But they were repeatedly targeted for abuse, including from outside groups, culminating in what they call a brutal mob assault on April 30th. The live-streamed attacks on students and faculty were carried out for at least 4 hours while UCLA security stood by. The university called in police the following day to forcefully and violently remove the protesters. The plaintiffs describe enduring physical and psychological harm. This is Binyamin Moryasef, an Israeli-American undergraduate plaintiff who accused UCLA of anti-Semitism over its silencing of Jewish anti-genocide voices on campus.
This lawsuit asks for the barest of respect towards the right to free expression, the right to voice our righteous opposition to the ever-present reality of imminent death every Palestinian child faces so long as the Israeli military continues its aggression. I ask the university not to collaborate with the oppressive forces of our time, unless they wish to be remembered like the heartless administration that arrested the Vietnam War protesters. Choose now to stand on the side of justice.
Meanwhile, at Cornell University here in New York State, outspoken international student activist Mamadou Tal has filed a lawsuit along with two others seeking to block Trump's executive orders targeting Palestinian rights activists. The three Cornell plaintiffs argue they've been unconstitutionally silenced. Last year, Mamadou Tal, a British and Ghanaian national, was twice suspended for his activism by Cornell, which moved to cancel a student visa, but ultimately backed down. Tal says law enforcement agents started following him around after he filed his lawsuit earlier this week. Supporters at Cornell mobilized Thursday to demand hands off Mamadou. Last month, Tal told Democracy Now! Why he would never stop advocating for Palestinian rights.
When we say Palestine is a litmus test, we're saying that it is not that we privilege the Palestinian cause among over every other cause, but rather Palestine holds a mirror up into the world and says, what kind of world do we want to live in?
To see our full interview with Mamadou Tal, go to democracynow.org. On Thursday, organizers say more than 1,000 Jewish activists from groups including If Not Now and Jews for Racial and Economic Justice rallied in front of the Manhattan headquarters of ICE to demand the release of Columbia student activist Mahmoud Khalil, who was picked up by federal immigration agents March 8th and remains in a Louisiana detention center. We'll have the latest on Mahmoud Khalil's case later in the broadcast. Two House Democrats have openly called for Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer to be replaced amid mounting anger over his vote backing the GOP government spending package. Congress members Glenn Ivey and Delia Ramirez made the comments during recent town halls. Senator Schumer was forced to postpone his book tour amidst widespread voter backlash and planned protests. Meanwhile, the Democratic National Committee announced it's going to host town halls in Republican-held House districts around the country. And in related news, Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has joined Senator Bernie Sanders as he continues his fighting oligarchy tour, addressing packed crowds and overflow rooms in Republican and swing districts across the United States. The pair addressed 5,000 people in Tempe, Arizona, on Thursday.
We're not going to allow you and your friend Mr. Musk and the other billionaires to wreak havoc on the working families of this country. No, you're not going to destroy Social Security. You're not going to destroy Medicaid. You're not going to destroy the Veterans Administration.
Bernie Sanders has been visiting areas where the district's own congressional representatives have neglected to meet with constituents. House Speaker Mike Johnson has urged fellow Republicans to avoid town hall meetings after confrontations with concerned voters. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Trump signed an executive order Thursday to start dismantling the Department of Education, though the agency can't be formally shut down without congressional approval. Since taking office, Trump's already slashed the department's workforce in half and cut $600 million in grants. Trump's executive order instructs Education Secretary Linda McMahon to begin shutting down the agency.
My administration will take all lawful steps to shut down the department. We're going to shut it down and shut it down as quickly as possible. It's doing us no good. We want to return our students to the states where just some of the governors here are so happy about this. They want education to come back to them, to come back to the states, and they're going to do a phenomenal job.
For the signing ceremony, Trump created a fake classroom inside the White House, flanked by school children sitting at desks. They were given fake executive orders to sign as well. Many groups have criticized the move to shut down the department. Kerry Rodriguez, president of the National Parents Union, said, quote, "Let's be clear. Before federal oversight, millions of children, particularly those with disabilities and those from our most vulnerable communities, were denied the opportunities they deserved," she said. Gerald Griggs, the president of Georgia's NAACP, also criticized Trump's move.
Everybody says they want to support children. They have a right to life. But what happens after they're born? They have to be educated. And if you're cutting the Department of Education, whose sole purpose is to provide a quality education for all of Americans, but particularly those that are in public schools, I think this is ill-fated and will be very detrimental to this state and the United States.
The White House says several critical programs will continue, including student loans and federal Pell Grants. We go now to Gloucester, Massachusetts. We're joined by Jennifer Berkshire, co-author of the book The Education Wars, A Citizen's Guide and Defense Manual. She's also host of the education podcast Have You Heard? Her recent piece for The Baffler is headlined Cruel to Your School, Trump's War on Public Education. Jennifer Berkshire, thanks so much for being with us. Why don't you start off by explaining what the Department of Education does?
Well, first of all, thanks so much for having me. And when it comes to the Department of Education, it's so easy to venture into the weeds and to get lost in those programs and the acronyms. But when you quoted Kerry Rodriguez, she was exactly right. Those programs, those things like Title I, they were set up in order to smooth out the vast disparities that we've long had in this country, that disparities between kids based on race, where they live. And so the Department of Education provides 10% of education funding around the country, primarily to low-income schools and rural schools. And when you think about the real focus of the efforts of the Trump administration to weed out what they would call woke or DEI, this is really it. It's anything that the government does to make the country more equal. That's why they're going straight at these programs. And it's also why public education as an institution is so vulnerable right now.
talk about children with disabilities. You know, there's the whole discussion of DEI, of diversity, equity, and inclusion. But it really actually is DEIA, diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility. Can you explain, Jennifer?
Yes, absolutely. So people don't realize just how recent it is in this country that students with disabilities are guaranteed the right for a free and appropriate education. You can still meet people who came of age in the 70s and had, you know, siblings who didn't have, school could just turn them away because they had a disability. And because we have a law in the books called IDEA, Linda McMahon did not know what it stands for, but it is the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. And so basically, students have a right that's enforced through the Department of Education. And so it's no coincidence at all that in those layoffs that you mentioned, they went really hard at the division that enforces civil rights. The overwhelming majority of civil rights complaints are from parents who are seeking services and access for kids with disabilities. And basically, the department is saying now, you know what? We're no longer going to enforce your right. Instead, we're going to turn what's left of our civil rights division into a sort of a weaponized, lean machine that goes after alleged acts of anti-Semitism, and then also things that they suspect of having to do with gender ideology.
And Trump vowing to fully preserve popular programs like Pell Grants?
That was a real tell, I thought, that you heard him talk about preserving programs that the Department of Education now oversees, things like Title I and funding for special education and Pell Grants, because he knows that getting rid of these programs would be very politically unpopular. And so he's sort of talking about it in the same way that they're talking about Social Security and Medicare. Like, we see them off stage mucking about, but we're being assured that there won't be any interruption in essential services. But as we know from reading the playbook, that would be Project 2025, the goal is not to continue to spend the same amount of money, but just in a different way. It's ultimately to phase out spending. It's to privatize the loan portfolio and make it more difficult and more expensive for kids to go to college. And these are things that I think are really unpopular with American voters across party lines, which is why you don't hear the Trump folks really, you know, admitting where their ultimate destination is.
Jennifer Berkshire, how does this executive order fit into the broader war on public education?
It was really telling to see who Trump picked to join him in that weird scene where he signed the order. So you have the kids at the desk, but then you have some of his favorite governors. Now, why are they his favorite governors? Because they are all in states that either have or in the process of implementing what are called universal school vouchers. So this means that the state now picks up the tab for parents to send their kids to private religious schools. And most importantly, like, that money is not going to pay the cost of kids who are leaving public schools. It's now going to pay the tuition for parents who already sent their kids to private religious schools, which means that increasingly in states like Ohio and Indiana, you have the government paying for the very wealthy to send their kids to private religious schools. So why would this be your vision? Because if Trump had wanted to assemble, like the states that are doing the best on, say, standardized tests, this would not be the crew you'd have, right? Florida was so unhappy with how it fared on the latest round of what we call the nation's report card that the Secretary of Education wrote to complain that the test was rigged. And think about somebody like Indiana, your governor's there. Indiana stopped investing in public education, K-12 and higher education 15 years ago. And as a result, college attendance has plummeted and the state is doing really poorly economically. I think it's actually very indicative of where Trump sees us heading, which is to a sort of a meaner, less prosperous, more divided and inequitable future. And you saw it right there on that weird set.
And the how this relates to Project 2025 and Christopher Rufo, Jennifer?
Yeah, so they're basically, they have laid out the playbook, and it's really important to pay attention to what they've been telling us all along. I see so many commentators scratching their heads wondering, you know, what are they up to? Why are they focused on these programs? But we've got, say, a Christopher Rufo out there saying that his goal is to see the percentage of kids who attend college drop by half. Right? That tells you something about the vision that's out there. When Trump talks about returning education to the states, he's talking about the vision that was laid out in Project 2025. And that is really sending funding back to the states in the form of block grants that they can do whatever they want with. Well, we know what they want to do with the money because we saw who was on that stage yesterday. They want to devote an increasing percentage of their education dollars to private and religious schools that don't have to accept all kids. It's a real step backwards, and it's one that I think that we should all reject.
Finally, what causes you most alarm as President Trump promises to shutter the Department of Education, though somehow needs congressional approval at the very end?
What gives me most alarm is what a poor job the Democrats have been doing. Speaking up on behalf of public education as an institution and reminding us why we need it and what we stand to lose when it disappears. And I'm hoping that as we start to possibly see some signs of life among the Democrats, that they will lean into this issue. So that both gives me hope, but it also causes me not a slight amount of despair right now.
Jennifer Berkshire, co-author of The Education Wars, A Citizen's Guide and Defense Manual, will link to your new article in The Baffler, Cruel to Your School, Trump's War on Public Education. Coming up, an update on Mahmoud Khalil, the Columbia student protest leader, now spent 2 weeks in ICE detention. They've revoked his green card. We'll also look at how the State Department's using AI, artificial intelligence, to identify pro-Palestinian foreign nationals to target for deportation. Stay with us. And Grenades by Hugh Masekela. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to look at the Trump administration's targeting of foreign-born students who've expressed support for Palestinians. Columbia student protest leader Mahmoud Khalil has been jailed in ICE detention for 2 weeks, even though he's a legal permanent resident of the United States. On Wednesday, U.S. District Judge Jesse Furman cleared the way for Khalil to stay in the U.S. and keep challenging his arrest. The judge transferred Mahmoud Khalil's case to New Jersey, where he was initially held before being transferred to Louisiana. Earlier this week, Mahmoud Khalil dictated a letter to his lawyers. He said in part, quote, "The Trump administration is targeting me as part of a broader strategy to suppress dissent. Visa holders, green card carriers, and citizens alike will all be targeted for their political beliefs. In the weeks ahead, students, advocates, and elected officials must unite to defend the right to protest for Palestine. At stake are not just our voices, but the fundamental civil liberties of all," he said. We're joined right now by Shaza Abushi Dalal, a staff attorney with the CLEAR Project at CUNY School of Law, a member of Mahmoud Khalil's legal defense team. Thanks so much for being with us. We've been following this very closely, and there's been mass protests across the country. Thousands have turned out protesting for Khalil. His wife, an American citizen, left here in New York. She is 8 months pregnant. Explain the latest. Explain Judge Furman's decision and what it means for Khalil to be going to New Jersey, if he in fact is. He's still in Louisiana.
That's exactly right. Thank you for having me, Amy. On Wednesday, Judge Furman in the Southern District of New York ordered the case transferred to a federal court in New Jersey. And in doing so, Judge Furman acknowledged that the right court to hear this is here in the area where all of these events played out, where Mahmoud's family is, his 8 month pregnant wife is, his community is, and his lawyers are, and rejected the government's argument that the right court to hear this is in Louisiana, where they covertly transferred him over the course of hours of his nighttime detention 2 weekends ago.
Which makes it very difficult for you to speak with him, right? You wanted the defense team demanded that they be able to speak, not monitored, because in fact, that's what happens at ICE detention facilities.
That's right. What you're referring to is that during our first court appearance in the Southern District of New York, we sought and received a court order allowing us to have legal calls with our client. Regular calls in ICE detention facilities are subject to monitoring by the government and therefore use against people who are being detained. So we had not been able at that point to have those types of legal calls. Thanks to that court order, we have been able to since. We are ready to continue this legal battle in New Jersey, where a number of really important legal battles will be hashed out in the days and weeks
and
to come.
And why New Jersey, even though he was first transferred, what, to Elizabeth? But Judge Furman,
that's right,
while he said he should be brought up from Louisiana, said New Jersey, not New York. And why is that significant to you?
He said New Jersey because at the exact time when, and this was in the early hours of the morning, hours from Mahmoud's detention, at the exact time when the habeas petition challenging his unlawful detention was filed, he was in an ICE detention facility in Elizabeth, New Jersey. So the court ordered transfer to New Jersey because of that fact, and again, acknowledging that contrary to the incredible claims that the government is making that Louisiana is the right court to hear this, to have him battle out the challenge to his unlawful detention in Louisiana would mean to have him fight his case in a state that is 1,400 miles away from his 8 months pregnant wife, who's due next month, from us, his counsel, and from the place where all of this played out.
I want to turn to the video showing the arrest of Mahmoud Khalil on March 8th, when he was detained by plainclothes officers who did not identify themselves. The video was filmed by his 8 month pregnant wife, Dr. Noor Abdallah, whose voice you're hearing in this clip.
You're going to be under arrest. So turn around.
Okay, he's not resisting. He's giving me his phone, okay? Can you please specify what agency is taking him, please? Excuse me. They're not talking to me. I don't know. Excuse me. The lawyer would like to speak to somebody. Oh my God, they're literally running away from me.
So there we have the video that the ACLU released. Mahmoud could not know who these people were. It was a plain, they were in plain clothes. The car was plain clothes. It was in their lobby. And what about this news of Elvin Hernandez, a DHS officer who Trump had honored in his first term in the presidency, I think pointed him out at the State of the Union address. He was one of those who arrested him?
Yeah, so you can see in the video how alarming and distressing the whole ordeal was. You have multiple Department of Homeland Security agents in plain clothes closing in on Mahmoud and his wife in the lobby of their Columbia faculty.
They just come back
Columbia
from Iftar.
Housing. Yeah, that's exactly right. They were entering their building coming back from Iftar. This is Columbia University housing, and they're followed in and closed in on by a bunch of agents in plain clothes. And they're having trouble receiving any information at all from these men about who they are. They're pleading for information about who they are, where they're being taken, and receiving next to nothing, as
you
can see.
Did Columbia give them permission, ICE, DHS permission, to go in their housing? I mean, Mahmoud had appealed to the Columbia president in the days before, saying he faced danger.
We don't know what Columbia has done, but what we know is what we see, which is that these officers are inside of the building, again, Columbia housing. And we also know from Mahmoud and his wife that they pleaded for assistance from the Columbia University administration in the days leading up to this detention and arrest. And they received no support. They have yet to receive any sort of support or outreach from the university. And we know that Columbia University has had a track record for over the course of the past, you know, more than a year and a half of collaborating with law enforcement agencies, giving them information, inviting them onto campus to arrest their own students. Certainly, they've taken the posture of collaborators and not a protective posture of their students, their staff, their faculty against this administration and the last's agendas to target advocates for Palestinian rights and liberation.
I want to read more from Mahmoud Khalil's letter from jail. He wrote, "My arrest was a direct consequence of exercising my right to free speech as I advocated for a free Palestine and end to the genocide in Gaza. While I await legal decisions that hold the futures of my wife and child in the balance, those who enabled my targeting remain comfortably at Columbia University. Knowing fully that this moment transcends my individual circumstances, I hope nonetheless to be free to witness the birth of my firstborn child." Shehzad Bushid-Alal, thank you so much for giving us this update. Staff attorney with the CLEAR Project at CUNY School of Law, member of Mahmoud Khalil's legal defense team. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. After Mahmoud Khalil was detained 2 weeks ago, President Trump warned he was the, quote, first arrest of many to come. Trump's warning comes as the State Department's launched a program to use artificial intelligence to scrape the social media accounts of foreign nationals, including students, to identify possible targets for deportation. We're joined right now by Faiza Patel, Senior Director of the Brennan Center for Justice's Liberty and National Security Program. Her new piece for the Brennan Center is headlined, "U.S. AI-Driven Catch and Revoke Initiatives Threatens First Amendment Rights." Thanks so much for being with us, Faiza. Explain what is going on.
So one thing that's going on is something that's been going on for a really long time, which is that government agencies have been collecting social media information. They've been scraping social media. They've been keeping tabs on what Americans are saying. And this is something that started during really the end of the Obama administration, continued through the first Trump administration, and continued through the Biden administration. And I think it's important to also understand two things. One is AI-driven. Sounds really fancy. I mean, basically, what they're going to be doing is keyword searches. And we've seen this play out with, as with their attempts to identify so-called DEI initiatives, which led to things like, you know, removing information about the Enola Gay. So I think you have a sense of
the plane that dropped the bomb on Japan and
precisely.
They took out the word gay.
Well, they just took out the whole reference, right? I mean, you see this playing out. I mean, they make a lot of really rudimentary mistakes, right? Because there's no context, there's no understanding. You're doing keyword searches and you're taking things offline in the case of the DEI stuff. But when you translate that over to the social media scraping context, you can understand how that will work out, right? Because they will be looking for certain terms and they will be targeting people based on the speech. And that can sweep very, very broadly. In the current context where they're, you know, going after pro-Palestinian protests, you've got to ask, right? Is the fact that I liked a Free Palestine post going to be enough to have me deported? I mean, foreign students are running scared because, you know, they may have done something very innocuous in social media, and now they're in the crosshairs. But I also think it's important to remember that, you know, the focus on pro-Palestinian speech is sort of the tip of the iceberg. If you look at the executive order that Trump put out, which sort of previews this program, it's not just about what he characterizes as pro-terrorist, pro-Hamas speech. It's also about anything that the administration considers as being basically un-American, right? And so that covers a vast swath of speech. It covers all kinds of protest activity, from environmental, pro-migrant, I don't know, pro-democracy, pro-voter. You know, it's a wide space that can be covered here.
Are you concerned about this latest news we had in headlines? President Trump rescinded an executive order targeting the law firm Paul Weiss, Rifkin, Wharton & Garrison after meeting in person with its chair. Under the deal, the law firm will provide $40 million in free legal services supporting Trump's agenda, including his task force to combat anti-Semitism. This is a law firm. And yet we just had a Jewish UCLA student, Israeli-American Jewish UCLA student, saying it's anti-Semitic to go after Jewish students who are protesting against Israel's war on Gaza.
I mean, I think there's a lot of concern overall that civil society institutions have been crumbling almost in the face of pressure from the Trump administration. And I think that sweeps across the board to media organizations that have settled lawsuits with him, universities that, I mean, there was a report in the Wall Street Journal that Columbia was going to accede to the demands from the Trump administration. And there has been a lot of pressure on the law firms as well. So this is, you know, you can't look at any one of these things in isolation. I think it's an overall attack on civil society institutions that could potentially block his agenda.
So it's a catch and revoke program. Mm-hmm. Explain that further and how that fits into the First Amendment and privacy rights.
Sure. So, I mean, this is a play, right, on catch and release, which was basically the term that was used to describe the policy of sort of apprehending people at the border who are asylum seekers and then releasing them into the country because our immigration court system just really doesn't have the capacity to address their claims in a timely fashion. And we don't actually have detention capacity either. So that's it's a play on that term. And what that means is, I mean, the catch part is basically we're going to figure out who was involved, and currently we're looking at pro-Palestinian protests, who was involved in these protests, and they have a few different sources for that. There are some organizations that have been, you know, doxing people who took part in protests, and they claim to have provided that information to the State Department and to DHS, so that's one source. The other source is going through social media. Now, they have an advantage when it comes to foreigners when going through social media, because since the last, oh gosh, I'm going to space in the time, but I think like 7 years or so, the State Department has been collecting social media handles from everybody who applies for a visa. That's 14.7 million people a year, roughly. And they actually now want to expand that program to another 33 million a year, which includes people who are in the United States who may be applying for, you know, immigration benefits. You know, I'm here on a student visa, I get a job, I want to apply for a work visa. So they're trying to extend that. So this is all like this whole complex. So once they know your social media handle, right, they can track what you say online very, very easily. Now, you can create new handles, but, you know, that gives them a baseline to start from. And that means that, you know, everybody's speech can be monitored. And it's not actually just the person whose handle you have, right? It's not just Khalil, for example, in this case, if they were monitoring him, they would also be then, you know, figuring out who his networks are, who the people are in the United States, who are his friends, who are his work colleagues, who are his teachers. It's a very pervasive effort.
And finally, Trump's proposal for a new travel ban that would target citizens of dozens of countries. Draft list of recommendations suggest a red list of 11 countries, including Afghanistan, Bhutan, Cuba, Iran, Libya, North Korea, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, Venezuela, and Yemen.
I mean, this is a, you know, a redo of what he did in his first term. And I think one of the things that's super scary about it is that he's also directed the Secretary of State to go back and look at people who got visas in the previous 4 years under the Biden administration and see if they can be deported, too.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us. And Faiza Patel is Senior Director of the Brennan Center for Justice's Liberty and National Security Program. Her new piece for the Brennan Center will link to USAI-driven Catch and Revoke Initiative Threatens First Amendment Rights. Coming up, we look at the newly declassified JFK assassination documents. We'll speak with Peter Kornbluh. Stay with us.
Because I think I have a light now. It's been such a long time since I was in love.
Spring is coming with a strawberry in the mouth by Operating Theater. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show looking at the federal government's release of around 80,000 pages of documents related to the 1963 assassination of President John F. Kennedy. While the documents have revealed few new revelations on the assassination, the unredacted files are filled with details about covert CIA operations around the world, from the Vatican to Latin America. One document revealed 47% of political officers working in overseas U.S. embassies in 1961 were actually intelligence agents working under diplomatic cover. At the U.S. Embassy in France, the CIA had 123 undercover agents acting as diplomats. The documents also shed new light on CIA activity across Latin America, including in Cuba, the Dominican Republic, and Bolivia. Those are just some of the revelations highlighted by the National Security Archive, an independent organization that's been reviewing the documents. We're joined now by Peter Kornbluh, senior analyst for Latin America at the National Security Archive. He's researched CIA operations for decades with a focus on Latin America. His books include Back Channel to Cuba, The Hidden History of Negotiations Between Washington and Havana, and Bay of Pigs Declassified, the secret CIA report on the invasion of Cuba. He's joining us now from Wellfleet, Massachusetts. Peter, welcome back to Democracy Now! What's in these tens of thousands of pages of documents that you're continuing to plow through?
Well, we don't have enough time to talk about all the details of the early 1960s history of the CIA kind of global effort to influence elections, sabotage economies, overthrow governments. But we've learned a lot more of the minutiae, the granular kind of side of these covert operations, names, places, shell companies, expenditures, so many little details that really complete, I think, in many ways, our sense of the universe of covert operations and what they targeted, how they happened, how they, you know, were organized. I mean, it's fascinating from a historical point of view. You know, the U.S. taxpayer, Amy, has shelled out a lot of money for decades now to have these documents kept secure and clean in the vaults of the national security agencies of the U.S. government. And now finally we are accessing this history that we paid for, that we've paid to we paid for it to happen. We financed the CIA with our money back way back when. And now at least we know what was being done in our name, but without our knowledge.
So you write that on the day President Kennedy's inauguration in January 61, nearly half of the political officers serving in the U.S. embassies were CAS, C-A-S, intelligence officers working under diplomatic cover known as controlled American sources. What's the significance of this, Peter?
But simply the significance is that whereas most people thought these were actually State Department officials in U.S. embassies around the world, almost half the people in these embassies, particularly using the office that was called political officer, were CIA undercover agents. It's pretty incredible. As Arthur Schlesinger pointed out in this extraordinary memo that's been completely declassified now to John F. Kennedy on June 10th, 1961, 3,700 officers around the world were CIA officials under diplomatic cover, in comparison to 3,900 of actual diplomats around the world. So it was almost 50%, and that's quite an extraordinary number. And I think a number of countries will be surprised at the kind of level of to which the U.S. embassies were being used as cover for the CIA. Again, this is all in the past. It's old history. We've known for many years that political officers were often used disguise CIA operations. And there were other parts of the embassies too, the labor attachés, the commercial attachés, et cetera. And then there were the CIA officers that were operating in countries like Chile and Bolivia and Brazil and elsewhere, who weren't in the embassies at all. But it's a tidbit of covert operations history that certainly is dramatic and reminds us of what the United States was doing around the world and is capable of doing in the future.
In light of the U.S. cracking down even more on Cuba right now, especially young people may not know how many assassination attempts there were against Fidel Castro. Is it in the range of 600? And then I want to follow that up with a question about one of the JFK assassination documents being released, about the Inspector General's report of the 61 successful, if you call it that, assassination of Rafael Trujillo of the Dominican Republic, revealing the names of CIA officers and others who assisted in the plot. Can you talk about this?
Well, the 600 or so figure about assassination attempts on Fidel Castro comes more from Cuban intelligence than from U.S. intelligence. Every attempt by any exile group that the Cuban intelligence intercepted or learned about was added up, and those were quite a few. The CIA itself counts about 16 earnest CIA-sponsored attempts, which now have become folklore of covert operations history, exploding seashells, poison cigars, sniper rifles, et cetera. So, we've known about those assassination plots for a long time. There is one document, an internal CIA Inspector General's report on the assassination in late May of 1961 of Rafael Trujillo, the dictator of the Dominican Republic. And it's quite detailed. It names the names of all the CIA officers involved, including their code names that they used in their discussions with coup plotters and the assassination team in the Dominican Republic. It names all the names of the coup plotters as well that the CIA was working with, the name of the actual covert operation, which was called EM-Deed, and the actual assassination plot, which was called EM-SLU. So there are a lot of details on that history. And, you know, you get to learn not only how the CIA works with foreigners to assassinate a head of state, in this case, the dictator Rafael Trujillo, but you also learn how the CIA goes about investigating its own wrongdoing of the past, the files that it keeps, how they are reviewed, what they yield, et cetera. So it's quite fascinating from a historical point of view.
We've done a lot on USAID and Trump's getting essentially shuttering the agency. You've covered foreign policy in Latin America for decades. Can you talk about the story of the USAID's Office of Public Safety?
You know, that's, again, part of the folklore of covert operations. There was a famous movie made about Dan Mitrione, and who was an officer in the Office of Public Safety. It was never completely proven that he was a CIA official. He was kidnapped and executed in Uruguay by the Tupamaros, became a very famous case. There is evidence in these declassified documents that the CIA did use AID as cover. But, you know, that was a long time ago. And even if it was doing that, there's still quite a bit more to USAID than CIA covert operations. And so when we talk about AID being shuttered today, we're talking about programs that were literally saving lives every day, providing food bought from U.S. farmers, by the way, by the federal government, and food, medicine, vaccines, quite a bit of support to many of the causes that we actually care about. So it's easy to look back on the older history of USAID when it was first started as a tool of the Cold War. The Cold War has been over for a long time now, so closing it down now is simply a crime against humanity, frankly, in my opinion, because so many people will die and suffer and become ill and impoverished by this cruel act of simply closing the doors of the USAID programs.
Peter Kornbluh, The New York Times reports a senior official at the main U.S. aid agency, which is being dismantled by Trump, told employees to clear safes holding classified documents and personnel files by shredding the papers or putting them into bags for burning, according to an email sent to the staff. The significance of this, you as an archivist who deeply wants to understand what is happening and has happened in the past.
Well, there is a Federal Records Protection Act, a law that prevents documents from just being wantonly destroyed, erased, shredded, burned, as this email that you refer to indicated. And so that was very alarming when that news broke and that email was shared with the kind of legal community. It also spoke to the issue of whether these documents might have been relevant in the ongoing lawsuits, the legal pushback by AID employees to save their jobs and save their institution. Legal efforts that are underway right now, and those documents might have actually been relevant to those legal efforts. You know, we my organization joined in protesting that action. It was the subject of court discussion. We don't know. We don't have an index of what documents were actually shredded that day and burned that day. But hopefully at some point we will. But that speaks to a different issue, Amy, that I hope we want to raise before we go, which is, you know, part of what's important about the declassification of the John F. Kennedy documents is not just what's in the documents. It is the law that mandated that declassification, which is known as the JFK Act and passed in 1992. And it was a law that's probably the strongest law on declassification that's ever been written. It created an independent panel outside of the national security agencies to oversee the declassification of the documents. It mandated that with very few exceptions, the documents be released without censorship, without redactions. And this is a law that really is very important. now that it's been fully implemented by, ironically, Donald Trump, you know, it's a law that creates a new standard and a new precedent for openness and transparency. And it's very important that now that we have that standard, we apply that standard to the very administration that is in power today.
And it's interesting that while he's released the JFK files, the Shabazz family is asking for the release of the Malcolm X files, which he has yet to do. Peter Kornbluh, in the last 30 seconds, I wanted to get your response to President Trump basically also shuttering Voice of America and Radio Marti, particularly the news, if you could call it that agency, that was broadcasting into Cuba U.S. propaganda.
Well, he has shuttered the Cuba programs. USAID had Cuba democracy programs, which were very objectionable to the Cubans. Those are gone now. Radio Marti, TV Marti, gone now. That does not mean that Trump is not going to be pressuring Cuba in other ways. But at least the Cuba programs are gone. People who look closely at the Voice of America will know that they've used our documents in many stories that they've done. They, too, are not the Cold War product that they once were and had some value around the world.
We're going to have to leave it there, but we'll continue in a post show at democracynow.org. Peter Kornbluh, senior analyst for Latin America National Security Archive.
Wolf Island and Kingston Massive, Saturday,